Welcome to Life, Passion and Business. My name is Paul Harvey, and I'm looking for answers. What does it mean to be successful? What does it mean to have a good, well-lived life? This podcast is conversations with people that look like they have it sorted. Hello, I am back in my studio, and I have to say you have no idea how good it feels to be back in a comfortable chair and working at my desk. So my guest on today's programme is Simon Middleton. He was a connection I followed and made through LinkedIn. So imagine my surprise during our conversation when I discovered that Simon is the author of Build a Brand in 30 Days, a reference source I regularly use with marketing clients. It is true to say that Simon is in his later years and has had a long and varied career. On leaving education, he trained as a primary school teacher. On qualification, he discovered that teaching was not for him. Moving into public relations, he honed his creativity and writing skills. And then in one of those volte-face moments, he decided to retrain as a nurse and spent 10 years working in the NHS. On leaving the health service, in another career shift, he returned to PR and branding world. And it was a time of accelerated growth and his career took off. Writing books, speaking at events, running a successful brand agency. He did the TV slots, he did the world travel. And then, moving on again for health reasons, Simon relocated to his beloved Suffolk and he found inspiration on the beach and then the harbour at Southwold. And it was that inspiration that led to the launch of a new menswear clothing brand, Blackshaw. In our conversation, you will hear us enjoying the journey. We touch on brandings, we touch on stories, what is success, the meaning of life, and why TV detectives tend to drive Volvo cars. I hope you enjoy the conversation with Simon Middleton. Hello and welcome to Simon Middleton. Thank you for taking the time out to be with me today on the programme.
It's a pleasure. Nice to speak to you.
Yes, it is great. I'm pleased we finally caught up. I was travelling last month and getting connections with people and technology at the same time was almost impossible. So, right. So it's nice to be back at my desk and, yeah. And in familiar surroundings today. So anyway, look, this is Life, Passion and Business. And I set up this podcast basically because I've reached a certain stage in my life where I have more questions than answers. I'm kind of going to myself, well, okay, I'm now 55 this year. And, you know, what's this life actually about? Because, you know, it's eating, drinking, you know, making love, having families and making money. But there is something kind of like missing for me or maybe missing. And am I missing out on something? So I thought, well, what I would do, I would reach out to people in the world that looked like they had the answers. Now, obviously, from the outside, everyone looks like they have the answer because no one actually knows what goes on behind closed doors. So I thought I'd reach out to various people. And in my LinkedIn process, you were one of the people that popped up around my thing. So I thought, hang on a minute, Simon looks interesting. And he's also involved in the garment industry, or is now, and I have a connection with that. So we'll talk about that in a minute. So Simon, tell me, how did you get to where you are now? What's your story?
Well, if you're looking for answers, you come to the wrong guy because it's all been a horrible mess of coincidence and chance and so on. So, yeah, I don't have any pearls of wisdom for anybody, really. But the story, you can pick out of it whatever you like. The story basically is that I born and raised in Lincolnshire, and went to school in Peterborough. There, but for the bulk of my life, I lived in Norwich in Norfolk. I went to what was then a teacher training college, is now part of the University of East Anglia. So I got a UEA degree, but I never really wanted to be a teacher. In fact, I realised within about half an hour of my very first day on my first teaching practice that I wasn't really cut out to be a teacher.
Too many children, he says.
Far too many children. Many children, yeah, exactly. And I think it must be infinitely tougher now. I'm going back to the late 70s, but anyway, I tried to get on a graduate program as a journalist with the Eastern Daily Press, which is the regional daily paper in the Norfolk and North Suffolk. The year that I graduated and applied for that graduate sort of fast track course, they canned it for some reason, so I didn't get on it. So I ended up in a PR agency, and which I really, really enjoyed. In fact, funnily enough, in a couple of weeks, we're having a reunion of the people in that agency. So that was my taste of the sort of world of marketing, but also it honed my creative skills and my writing skills and so on. So I was doing all kinds of things to do with PR, mm-hmm. writing, event stuff, dealing with clients, all kinds of things. And it was a kind of a rapid growing up. It was all pre-digital, of course. So in those days, it was typewriters and going around to the typesetters to organize newspapers and publications of one sort or another. And telephones,
yeah, God forbid, and
so it all sounds terribly primitive, but it was a really interesting period. And I spent 5 years in PR, and then I made a strange sort of left field decision, which was I was married to a nurse, and all of my friends seemed to be nurses, so I decided to train as a nurse, and I became a registered nurse working with people with severe learning disabilities. And I was in the health service for I think 7 or 8 years in total, first as a nurse and then as a manager, and did a lot of growing up during that time as well. And then in the early 90s I decided to leave the health service and try my hand back at writing again, but this time as a freelancer, and I quickly discovered that there was a market for someone who could write, turn their hand to any kind of writing. In the region, I started being a freelance copywriter for agencies, basically, and I was writing everything from brochures about new housing developments to describing new sofas for sofa manufacturers to all kinds of things, everything. The story short, that led me to working regularly for an agency in Norwich called Fox Murphy, who hired me first as creative manager, and then very quickly I was creative director. So I suddenly found myself with no real advertising background as the creative director of an agency, but an agency that was quite small at the time. It was about 30 strong. And then an interesting thing happened. I was involved in the process which led to that agency getting hired by Barclays, in a big shakeup of Barclays marketing at the end of the 90s. And suddenly that agency became a big player. It was went from about 30 odd people to at its peak over 100 people, and suddenly I was the creative director of something really, really exciting. So that, to be honest, there was so much luck involved in all of that. I have some skills, but it wasn't that I set out to do anything specific. There was never a plan beyond me knowing that I had some core skills around creating concepts, around writing, and to a certain extent, general communication skills. So then in 2005, I left that agency to set up on my own as a brand strategy consultant, and suddenly found myself running my own little business and speaking about branding all over the world, getting hired by all kinds of different clients, charities, corporates, small businesses, medium-sized businesses, to help them develop their brand story. And that turned into me writing a book called Build a Brand in 30 Days, which has done pretty well. I still earn royalties from that, and a couple of other books about marketing. And that led me in turn to developing my own brand, first in musical instrument retail, then in manufacturing, then in clothes manufacturing, with a brand called Shackleton. And then I retired from that about 2 years ago. And then I got a little bit bored and decided to start a new brand and have a new brand called Blackshaw, which is what I did. I look back on it, it seems like everybody, I think, where on earth did that time go? And sometimes I think that wasn't quite how I planned it, but the truth is I didn't plan it. So, but I've tried to wring as much pleasure and enjoyment and satisfaction and challenge out of it as I could. So that's how we got to where we are.
What a great story.
Well,
it's... And, you know, was it a great story when you're living it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, like everybody else, I had the same you know, ups and downs and challenges of, you know, family life and marriage and children and all of those things, some of which are wonderful and some of which are terrible. And I won't bore you with those now, but, you know, everybody has their share. And, but I think if I learned anything from that process, it's that I learned about myself as a personality, and we're all different from each other. And what I've learned is that I have certain characteristics that are positive and some that are negative. For example, I'm a terrible worrier. I panic easily. I get very, very, very low and very, very high. But I've learned to manage those. And the other thing I've learned is that actually, if you use your core skill set and sort of maximize that, then, you know, there's usually a way to make a living, I suppose, is what, at least that's what I've found.
Yeah, that's always what surprises about modern education. They seem to focus on people's, on children's faults rather than people's, on children's best bits.
Yeah.
So what you end up doing is you make an average person rather than a really good person. Because if you focus on the best bits, that actually, in fact, made those bits better.
Yeah, that's a very interesting insight. I think it's absolutely right that it's, I'm a definite believer in that school of thought that says, you know, it's much better to enhance your qualities than it is to try and ameliorate your faults, really. I am not a numbers person. There's no point in me pretending that I am. So I get somebody else to do that for me. I realized something a long time to catch on to it, perhaps, but that in my new business, Blackshaw, it needed social media activity around it. It's a men's clothing brand. In the past, I would have perhaps tried to tackle that myself. But this time round, I thought, no, come on, Simon, this needs not only someone younger to do this, who understands it culturally, but also someone who's more technically adept. And so instead of Blackshaw social media being done by a nearly 60-year-old man, it's now being done by a late 20s woman who is both skilled and experienced and hugely knowledgeable about what she's doing and speaks the language. And I'm perfectly happy now to pass that over to her and to say, you do that, because really when I do it, it looks a bit like dad dancing, if you know what I mean. It's clunky when I do it. I think one of the things I've learned as I've got older is to accept what's good, but also accept what's negative, and not try to be everything to everybody. It's not possible. It's maybe when you're younger, you can have a crack at everything, but as you move along through life, and you can only move in one direction through it, you have to make choices. And it's, you know, I'd rather choose to do the things that I'm good at and enjoy and get some value from.
Hmm. That's very valid. Very valid indeed. So what's the story of the new brand?
Well, the new brand was born in a way out of another life change, which I didn't really see coming, which was that left Norwich towards the end of 2017 and came to live. I live in actually a village called Raydon, but it's Raydon is next to a town. And by the Suffolk coast. And I live here now and absolutely love it. And I've managed to construct a life which doesn't necessitate me going out to work every day at the moment. So I was able to spend quite a long time kicking around on the beach at Southwold, walking up and down the harbour, part of which is known as the Black Shore, just in this amazing Suffolk coastal countryside, which is quite unlike anything else, really. Very, very beautiful. And I noticed there two things happened. One was that I got a bit bored with kicking around being a bit of a beach bum. I thought, actually, this retirement lark, this doesn't really suit me. And the other thing that happened was that I noticed there's things about the marketplace. There's a lot of people visiting Southwold at the weekends and holidays and so on. They all want to go shopping, and women are very well catered for. There are boutiques, independent boutiques that are very nice, some of them. There are street, high street brands like Sea Salt, but which have a very sort of coastal flavor. There are family brands like Jewels and so on. But there isn't really anything for older men. There are things for younger men, and there are things like Timberland or Jack Wills or Cuba or things like that. There isn't really anything that's focused, or white stuff. There isn't really anything that's focused on, let's say, men of a certain age, men over 40-ish, who want to kind of look good but aren't interested in fashion. They're more interested in style, but something that's appropriate for their relaxed lives at the coast. And that idea inspired me to create Blackshaw. And there's a couple of important things that we have built into the brand story. One is that it has this definite coastal aesthetic. So everything is based on a sort of workwear style, the kind of clothing that would be worn in a boatyard by fishermen, by lifeboat crews, etc., but sort of turned into a clothing that people could wear. The second thing was that we wanted it all to be made in Britain, because we can come on to that in a moment, but I'm a passionate believer in the renaissance of British manufacturing. And the third thing was that I wanted it to be of a such a distinctive quality that it would last and last and last. So, and I'd done a lot of impromptu research talking to men and women about their clothing choices and so on. And one of the things that came out of that was that men are, this is maybe a massive generalization, but it seems that men are reluctant buyers of clothing. And when they do buy something, they either want it to be very, very practical, or if it's something that they're spending quite a lot of money on because it's stylish, they want it to last. They don't want to have to replace it next season. So we're trying to create clothes that will actually get better as they get older. And one of the elements of that story is that we're offering this free lifetime repair. So if people buy a pair of trousers from us and 10 years from now the knee goes, or you know, the seam goes or whatever, they can send it back to us and we'll repair it. And it won't look like new. It'll look like it's been repaired, and it will be a kind of battle scar. And the same, if someone puts an elbow wears out in a jumper, we'll darn it in a complementary color so that they can show their friends, look, Blackshaw darned my jumper for me. We want them to have a story and to be proud of that story. So that's the thinking behind that brand.
That's amazing. It's a really interesting story. So the production, have you set the production up as well?
Everything is set up. I wasn't in a position, nor would I want to, frankly, sort to buy my own factory or set up my own factory. The original idea actually was to set up a small workshop with a few people in it down here in Southwold. But the challenge of doing that is the overheads of doing that are just too big to take on to start with. That's something we might consider in the future. But you could run, you know, we could kill the brand even before we began it with that sort of overhead. Yeah. So the whole range has been designed here. A great designer that I've worked with before called Sophie Miller, who lives in the Fens of Norfolk, actually about 20 miles north of here. I've worked with her before, so she's done the design. I've got a London-based creative director who's sort of overseen the whole thing and makes sure of its commerciality in terms of design. I have a business partner who lives in the Norfolk Broads, about 30 miles north of here. The concepts were all done on my dining room table here in Raydon near Southwold. And the manufacturing is being done with three partners in the UK. So we've got a factory in Blackburn in Lancashire that we've partnered with to do outerwear and trousers and shirts, jackets and things. Another one in Nottinghamshire who are making the knitwear for us, and another one in Buckinghamshire, in Milton Keynes actually, who are making jersey items, by which I mean t-shirts and sweatshirts and things like that. So it's a sort of virtual factory. It's scattered around, but it's all in the UK.
Well, that's how it used to be. I mean, I'm, you know, put my hand up here. I was the product development manager for Moreplan for nearly 15 years.
Ah, right. Okay.
I started with them when they were just coming out of a family business. So I was with that company for a long, long time. Mm. And that was very much in the garment trade when I was there. So I used to visit a lot of garment factories around the Midlands and stuff.
Yeah.
And certainly the economics of those factories was not a joyous thing to talk about. You know, they were running on a knife edge most of the time.
Yes, exactly. And I know what my limitations are. I don't want to be, you know, a factory owner. That's a different skill set.
Yeah.
But what I want to do is support those factories.
Yeah, you're coming from a different perspective on this, because a lot of those factories were tied into the major chain stores, and that's why they were running on a knife edge, because, you know, basically the chain store would say, you will make it at this price.
Yeah, quite.
Yeah, how? Well, I don't care. That's what you're going to make it at.
yes, that's true.
And if you can't, we'll go somewhere else. Mm. So, yeah, that's where the garment industry went. Mm. It basically went because it was basically throttled by the people buying clothes from it. So it's fascinating to hear that there are still places around that can make the stuff, and that you're...
Oh, there are. They're not in as massive numbers as they used to be, but there is there's a revival. There's definitely a renaissance. And I don't come from the clothing trade at all. I first got involved in apparel as recently as 2013. So it's, you know, my grand career in fashion is 5 years old, that's mm-hmm. all. I'm a late starter, but what I do have is, I think, two things. One is that I understand that, this is an assertion, my assertion, that story is mm-hmm. everything, you know, and story is, brand is synonymous with story, and that's fundamentally what people are buying in any field, whether they're buying cars or they're buying clothes, they're buying story. And the other thing is that, if you like, politically with a small p, or ideologically, I just think it's a terrible shame that we have lost so much manufacturing business and the manufacturing skills in this country. And I sense that there is something of a revival. I don't think it's ever going to go back to what it was, and nor should it, in a way, because we have to move forward. But I think this country can have a healthy clothing manufacturing industry, and I'd like to be part of that, it as with my business, rather than, because it was a simple choice. You know, I could conceive a brand for clothing, and I could either have it made cheap and cheerful in the Far East, or I could have it made less cheap and slightly closer to home in, you know, in Europe and so on, or I could make it in Britain. And cheap and cheerful in the Far East gives you certain benefits, but what it doesn't do is give you any added value in terms of story. Making it in Europe gives you certain benefits and a degree of quality, but again, it doesn't give you the storytelling element. But making it in Britain wires me in directly to people that I can get to know, factories that I can form a relationship with, a story to tell. And it seems to me to be a virtuous circle. I'm not knocking anyone else who chooses to manufacture. I'm a globalist. I'm not knocking people who manufacture overseas at all. I'm not anti it. I just chose to do it this way for me, because I don't have the skill set to sew my own trousers or to make jackets. You know, I don't have those skills. So I'd rather do it locally.
It fits in with the client market you're looking for, because the kind of people you're looking to sell those clothes to will respond to that story.
Yes, no, they won't do it. You have to be very canny about how you tell it, because they won't do it. It's not necessarily the number one on their priorities. I don't know many people who, you know, set out in the, you know, when on a shopping trip, I am going to buy a new jacket and it damn well better come from Britain. People don't do that. But what they do is look for quality and style. And then if they sort of open the jacket and they see it's made in Lancashire, or it's made in Britain, or, you know, then that's an added story, right?
Yeah,
so it's kind of third or fourth down the list, but I think it's something that adds, you know, it adds a bit of an extra punch.
I'm a marketer, and for me, that's the deal clincher, isn't it? It's a nice jacket. Oh, look, it's made in England. They're like, oh,
yes,
wow.
Exactly.
You know,
that's kind of the deal clincher.
That's the thing that goes, oh, right, okay. Now, and what happens in that conversation in their own mind is the price falls into place.
Yes, exactly.
There's any doubt on why the price was the price. Oh, it's made in England. Oh, well, I understand that now. You know. Yeah.
And what we're trying a model on that thought, on that subject actually of price, we're trying a model which is largely, not exclusively, but largely we'll be selling direct. So the idea is that we'll sell online, we'll sell through pop-up stores, we'll sell possibly at events, ultimately we'll sell through our own shops. But there'll be an intermediary period where we'll use the concession model. So and that's other brands have proved that the concession model is getting more popular, and that can really work. Now that means that although manufacturing in Britain, you sell direct or via concessions rather than wholesaling in the traditional manner, it means you can rein in some of those extra costs. There's extra margins that you can yeah. rein in. So whilst our clothes are never going to be cheap, they are going to be very competitive alongside equally stylish things that are not made in Britain. So I'm hoping, these are very early days, but I'm hoping that we might be able to still offer value, and that should be attractive, rather than people having to sort of really pay over the odds because it's made in Britain. Because, you know, it's a fine line.
It is, but you've also got the other thing. They're not just buying a jacket for now, are they? They're buying a jacket that will last a lifetime, effectively, because you're offering to repair it.
Well, that's our theory. Not only that, but and funnily enough, we were having a conversation about, we've had some samples made, and there's a couple of the samples that look absolutely beautiful, but very, very pristine. And we were talking about the possibility of beating them up a bit before we photograph them, because they're actually going to get better as they get older.
We know that jeans are washed in stones, don't you? That's how they get the jeans.
Well, yes. So it's that sort of concept. And people actually do artificially distress jeans. Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of it's done by laser and things now. So we're not going to go that far. I don't want to artificially distress things. It's just, I do want to get across the idea to people that, yes, it's lovely now, but you wait 5 years, it's going to be absolutely fantastic. there's a small American brand called Mr. Freedom, who make a lot of denim and things like that. And they get people to wear their clothes for a while before they photograph them. And then they photograph them then. And underneath the picture, they say, just as a sort of warning to the buyer, sadly, your jacket's not going to look as good as this when you first buy it. You have to work at it. So they're actually saying it's not finished yet until you've worn it for a couple of years, then it'll be finished. Well, and that's, I think with clothes is one of those rare things where you can actually do that. Some clothes genuinely do, if they're well made, just get better and better. Shoes can get better and better if they're well looked after and they're really well made to start with. And we're so used to having a society of, you know, things wear out, they get unfashionable and we dispose of them. And I'm sort of trying to go in, not exactly in the opposite direction, but play slightly counter to that.
Well, of course, I mean, if you go back, like, I guess it must be 100 years or 80 years ago, clothes were not something you bought and threw away, were they? They were something that mutated and were passed on. They were an asset. They were the asset of the family.
Yes, indeed, they were. Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
To put that into context, all right, I live in an old house in Scotland. It's a very old, it's 1893 this house was built. And when we moved here in 2004, we did quite a lot of renovation work on it. And one of the renovations that we did, we took up a lot of the floor, certainly upstairs. And we took up the bedroom floor. And in the bedroom floor, we found a hobnail boot.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know,
under the floorboards,
you know. Yeah, and I did a lot. And it was a very worn out hobnail boot. Clearly, I mean, it could have been repaired, but I guess they made the choice to put it in the floor. And when I looked up why it was in the floor, there's all sorts of traditions and things around fertility and around keeping the devil at bay and all sorts of things. And my wife said to me, that's bloody going back in the floor. I went, yeah, you're probably right. It's not coming out.
All right, too.
You know, but, you know, it's that, you know, that was an item of extreme value at the time and that was put in the floor. You know? So, we have a different relationship with our items that we buy. And I think what you're doing is coming completely different.
Well, it's one of the inspirations for it is the Blackshaw itself, this harbour at Southwold, which I spend a lot of time just hanging around on. I had a rather inglorious attempt to be a sailor for a while last summer. I bought. I'm selling it again now because I realise that I'm a terrible sailor, and put my own life and others at risk. So that's a story we won't go into. But by hanging around on the Blackshaw, looking at much more competent people than me with their boats, one of the things I realized is that, you know, nobody throws a boat away. It's you know, most of the boats on the Blackshaw owned either fishing boats, and there's a small fishing fleet there still, or pleasure boats, yachts, cruisers, and so on. Most of them are 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years old. Nobody throws a boat away. Sometimes they get hauled up onto the side of the bank and just sort of left to gradually, you know, entropy takes over. But that's either somebody runs out of money or they die or whatever. But most used boats just keep on going and get repaired, endlessly repaired, until it's almost like, is it the same boat? So it happens with wooden boats where, you know, you can virtually replace all the planks in a wooden boat's hull, and you questionably, is it the same boat? It happens with the GRP boats too. Everything gets replaced except the GRP hull. So, and I thought, this is a rather wonderful thing. If you can make a boat last for 50 years, why can't you make a jumper last for 50 years?
Well, you certainly can.
Yeah, that's the idea.
You darn it, as what grandmas used to do all those years ago.
That's what we intend to do, yeah, quite.
So I've loved to explore this story because it kind of appeals to the marketer in me. And also, I hadn't realized it until you mentioned it at the beginning, is I have your book on my shelf here, your 30-day branding plan. And it's one of the Bibles that I use with clients. So it's quite interesting that I have this unrealized connection with you. So this is life, passion, and business. And we've followed your story of your life and stuff, and we followed that, and we're exploring where you are now. So the question is, though, is that I'm asking really is, what is success?
What for me?
What does success mean to you?
Now, I hope this isn't going to sound too esoteric. I think success for me means finding kind of emotional equilibrium. And that might seem an odd answer from an entrepreneur. Frankly, although I very much want Blackshaw to succeed commercially for all the obvious reasons, frankly, that isn't my motivation. I really am not terribly interested in, I need enough money to, you know, live on and pay my bills, and it would be nice to have a pension. That's as far as my financial ambitions go. Success for me is absolutely about mental and emotional equilibrium. And I think that's a function of age, perhaps. I'll be 60 this year. I'm getting remarried next year, having had a rather turbulent few years, which is nobody's fault, but that's just the way it is. So I think since this is a thing about life and business, I'll be completely frank with you, I've had some mental health issues or emotional health issues, let's call them, over the last couple of years. And so success for me now is finding something that is challenging and stimulating and creative for me, but that allows me to be sort of at peace with the world and my place in it. So I used to be heavily involved in music. I used to write songs, play guitar, and sing, and I was the front man of a band for 20 years. We were a sort of amateur band, but we played lots of great gigs around the country and played support to all kinds of people and almost got signed. It was one of those sort of things, you know. We were enthusiastic amateurs. I left that about 4 years ago because of the pressures of my previous business. I just didn't have time. And I deeply, deeply kind of painful thing to have lost the camaraderie and the creativity of that. And I may well go back to it. I don't know. But there's a realization somewhere it's going to be Bruce Springsteen after all. And, you know, you're at best, you're going to be a good amateur band. But once you come to, and that's quite a painful thing process to go through. Once you've come to terms with it, then the pleasure begins, really. And I think the same applies to this business. I don't need want Blackshaw, for me at least. It doesn't have to be a world-dominating business. It has to be a business that I can do my very best with to create and to pay back the people who have invested in it, and ultimately to sell it. And for me to say, okay, you take it on now, guys, and make a massive success of it. That's fine. I'll look back and, you know, think I played a role in it. At the risk of repeating myself, success is to do with a certain kind of balance. I need to be stimulated, but not massively pressurized. I need time to, you know, smell the roses, if you like, or to smell the sea, as it were.
Yes. I wonder if that's, do you think that's a product of age?
Quite probably. I mean, I've been very fortunate as well as they've been a difficult few years. I've been very fortunate in the sense that I've now ended up in this place, Southwold, that I dreamt of living in for 30 years and used to visit dozens of times a year. And now I live here, albeit in a, you know, a very, very modest circumstances. But the circumstances don't matter to me. The place I live is just extraordinary, and I wouldn't swap it for anything. And maybe that is a function of age. My children are grown up, so I have a very lovely relationship with them, but I don't have all of the pressures that go with having children at home. And so perhaps I'm sounding like a grizzled old fool, but I think there may be that some wisdom comes with that. Not wisdom that I can offer to other people, but...
You sound like someone who's happy with their lot, actually.
Absolutely. Yes, I don't... To be perfectly honest, and it's really interesting to talk to you about this because you don't often get an opportunity to just discuss these things openly. I hope I'm not being too unguarded, but I think what's interesting is that out of a turbulent time can come a sort of new... a new chapter of a sort of peace. I still love music very much. And I was listening to an album the other day by a band called the Blue Nile, who were one of those kind of cult bands from the 90s, a Scottish band. I don't know if you're aware of them. Wonderful band. Anyway, and they have a song that called Peace at Last. And I think I've got it now. I've sort of found peace at last. But it doesn't mean not doing anything. It just means getting things in perspective.
So moving on from success, obviously your life, as you said, didn't actually have a plan. You kind of move from place to place and it kind of evolved around you. How have you maintained your passion? Because what I hear from a lot of people, and I say myself, I lost my passion for a lot of things. Mm. Clearly you're passionate about the new brand you're creating. Mm. But how do you maintain your passion? I mean, and keep finding new passion?
I think I have to push back on the question a bit. Other people might be able to maintain passion. I'm not sure I can or have done. I think it's that it's more that if I've decided not to be passionate about something for a while, that it seems to come back. So I thought when I left Shackleton and thought, you know, I've moved down here, my family circumstances are completely changed. I wasn't on top form for a while, to say the least.
No.
Kicked around for 6 months on the beach, writing a bit, reading a lot, thinking a lot. There was no passion in a new relationship, which has been very, very positive and arguably life-saving. But it was more about absorbing myself into the place rather than being passionate about anything in particular. But in that, having taken that time to sort of rest, as it were, the passion to create something resurfaced. So it could have been anything. You know, if things had happened differently, I might be doing something different now. But it just so happened that I was, as I would, I don't want to repeat the story, but, you know, wandering about in the Black Shore and got inspired, etc. And then I became passionate. So it's not like I had to maintain it. It's just, in fact, sometimes you have to let it go. The music thing was a passion. I was passionate about writing songs and singing and performing and playing in a band. And I absolutely loved it. And, but I think you, it was, you know, as as the song says, you know, nobody here gets out, nobody gets out of here alive. At some point you have to make choices. You can't do everything. And I, although it was very painful for me to leave music and songwriting behind, I think it was the appropriate thing to do, and I'm not unhappy with that. And that gave me space to kind of dream up a new passion, if you like. So it's not so much about maintaining. I think it's more about listening to yourself.
Yeah. So,
sounding terribly esoteric here, which is very unlikely.
Well, esoteric. I think this is the point, though, and I think people. Okay, what I've learned in the last 10 interviews that I've done is that there are some common threads in this, and some of the common threads are it is about following interest. It is about allowing space and a following interest. And our passions do change and move. And it's that's just it. That's a, whether it's bored or we become, it's something no longer fulfills us because we've been doing it and doing it and doing it, and there's nothing new to learn. Now, in music, that's different because there's always something new to learn in music if you're open to doing that. I imagine a band playing the same set every week would get very, very tired.
Well, yes, that's right. And actually, one of the things, the band that I was in, and the guys in the band have carried on and have morphed themselves into something completely different and rather wonderful, actually. But the common characteristic my old band had with their new band, and this and would remain true, is that we weren't a sort of pub covers band. We were constantly trying to create. So we were constantly writing songs, constantly changing styles, constantly experimenting. That was the passion for me. The creation was the real passion. As it happens, I also really like performing. Although at a drinks party, I'm a real wallflower. I'm desperately shy. I hate things like that. But once I get up on a stage, whether it's as a speaker or in the olden days as a singer, I'm completely fearless. But I miss that. But I think it's about this kind of the creative urge. I think we all have it, and it manifests itself in different ways. Sometimes, you know, it might be music, it might be art. My current creative urge is focused on desperately wanting to bring to life this range of beautiful clothes because I think they are as creative as anything else.
So how close is that? Has that happened yet already, or is there a launch date? Yes.
It's already online. The website's called blackshore.cc. So we're already taking orders, but on the website at the moment, there are only the designer's sort of illustrations. But within 48 hours, they will be replaced with the photographs, which were taken yesterday, funnily enough, and are being sort of post-production work done on them today. And they'll be going up on the website imminently. We've got samples of everything. It all looks fantastic. We've got a great team. We've got advance orders. What the stage we're at right now is that we're trying to raise capital. So we're looking for a founder called Andy Hilton, who invested some money right at the beginning to get us to this point. So it's taken us basically 6 months to get from a raw concept to a complete collection ready, sampled and ready to produce. But I can't press the green button. I can't phone up the factories and say, yes, please make 100 of this, 200 of that, until I have funding in place. So we've got a big funding challenge right now, and that's partly to do with making a business case, obviously, but it's also partly to do with winning the hearts as well as the minds of you know, one or two lead investors who might think, I really love this, I really love it, it might just work, but more importantly, I love the story, I love the passion, I love the art, the clothing, I'll back it. So we're at that point right now. And so, you know,
Sorry, I knocked you off your course, didn't I, by asking you about Blackshaw, and you were talking about, you know, the passion for Blackshaw, and I dived in and asked when it's going to happen. So it's interesting. So what is your passion for Blackshaw? Let's go back to that.
Well, the passion for that is, when I picture it, if I sort of close my eyes, you know, and you say, well, what's your passion? It's actually the stuff itself, the jackets, the jumpers, the clothing itself is so delicious. I can't really, that might seem like an odd word, and maybe, yeah, I think you'll understand it because you come from a background in apparel. Other people might find it less easy to relate to, but it's so beautifully made, and so I just want to wear it all. Mm. I want to stroke it almost. You know, there are wonderful fabrics, wonderfully designed and beautifully constructed, of kind of this sort of timeless masculinity in the style, and I just think, wow, I'm so glad I thought of this, because this is the best clothing brand I've ever seen. Sorry, say again.
I can hear the copywriter.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to sell it to you. I'm trying to explain about it.
No, I know you're not, but it's the way you're using words. Timeless masculinity is a lovely phrase.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was no. We had to make this one of the choices we had to make. Should we make a clothing brand for everybody, or should we make it for some people? And we decided we would make it. Basically, Andy, this is my business partner, and I decided to make it a clothing brand for blokes like us, who are blokes. We happen to be in our late 50s, but I have good friends who are, you know, 20 years younger, of course. But it's blokes basically from 35 upwards, but blokes with a certain kind of outlook. You know, they're likely to prefer to be kicking around on a beach than they are to be, let's say, driving a very fast car. They're likely to be more interested in going to gigs than they are to fine dining. That doesn't mean that they don't do that as well, but the things that turn them on, they're likely to gather with some of their friends and family and so on in a pub to watch one or two of the games in the Six Nations. You know,
you're talking about yourself, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, exactly. I am too, and that's why I'm so passionate, because I'm not trying to create a brand for a person whose head I can't get into. There's no point. No, I'm not sufficiently talented to create a fashion brand for urban youth. I just, I don't have that stretch of imagination. I simply can't do it. And there's other people who.
But there are other people that do. Other people that do it anyway. Other people do that.
So I'm creating here. Clothes for me to wear, because most of the clothes out there for me to wear are a bit dull.
Yes, I can understand that. And I think men's fashion is dull. I fully agree with you.
And I want to wear something that people go, wow, that's cool. Where'd you get that? Oh, yeah, that's...
Because I do struggle. I struggle to find clothes I want to wear. I absolutely thoroughly agree.
Well, there you go.
Totally agree with you.
There you go.
So, okay, we've been talking for 46 minutes and I am thoroughly enjoying our conversation. So let's start bringing this to an end in terms of... So... is there anything that I haven't asked you that I should have done?
Oh, goodness gracious.
Which is my way of giving you an open platform to say what you like.
But I'm not quite sure what the thrust is there. Do you want me to give advice, or do you want me to reflect on my regrets?
What I'm saying to you is actually that's it. Is there anything I'm giving you an opportunity to say? Like, is there anything that we've been talking for 46 minutes? Is there anything you think you're going to go, oh rats, I really wish I'd said that? And you can, and you know, that might come later. But if there's anything off the top of your head,
that's such an interesting question. I think that if we were to go on for another hour, which obviously we can't, but if we were, then I'd be very interested in exploring other aspects of sort of interior life, because it's not very often in a business oriented podcast or conversation. In fact, it's unique to me, this conversation. People don't ask me these questions, and that's what I think makes your podcast very interesting. Is that I would be very interested in talking about the interior life of the entrepreneur, if you like. For example, I'm passionate about reading and writing, and You know, I always, if I'm stuck, which I often am, then reading novels of one sort or another just helps. But equally, and that's, you might call that a bit more sort of highbrow, if you like. But equally, I'm really find enormous stimulation and comfort and help by watching what some people would regard as very lowbrow culture. So, like, I watch a lot of movies. I there's nothing I like better than to lose myself in, you know, television detective programs of the most unpleasant kind, you know, sort of Scandinavian noir sort of stuff. Now, some people would say, well, how is that feeding you? But actually, I find that immensely nourishing, because I'm not really interested in the procedure. What I mean is why these things are so popular these days, I think. It gives us an opportunity to get inside the heads of people who are struggling with a concept, with an idea, with a business, a work challenge, with a serial killer or whatever. So I'm always interested in talking to people about those things, because they're a sort of popular, those sort of popular culture things are the things where our brains can sort of touch each other on a large scale, where we get an insight into how each other think. So that's, you know, had we got more time, I'd love to talk about that. So, and there's a close relationship with branding there, because one, and I'll
well, I think,
sorry,
I think we should reschedule another conversation and start at that point.
All right.
Because I think there's a value here, and I would enjoy that conversation too. So I think that's very, very good.
Okay. Well, let me leave you with one thought, okay, which ties us back to my core expertise, which is branding. And this is how the Black Shawl got started. My core interest, if you like, is branding and brand storytelling. I'll just leave you this thought, and I won't try and prove it to you now, although I can. But here's why I think popular culture is really fascinating. If you pick 20 popular television detectives, right? 10 of those 20 at least drive Volvos. Why is that?
Oh,
I'll leave that question there.
That's almost essay worthy, isn't it?
I know it is. Discuss. Television detectives drive Volvos? Well, here's another one. Why do maverick journalists in movies drive Saabs? Always.
I had never connected these things with cars, to be honest. So, but it's an...
No, it's true, though. And I'll tell you why it is. The short reason is that in popular culture, easily absorbed symbolism is incredibly important. So when we see Luther get into a Volvo, or the Steve Arnott from Line of Duty get into a Volvo, or Kurt Wallander get into a Volvo, et cetera, we immediately have a button in our brains that says, that guy, we are safe with him.
Yes.
Or that guy is okay. So whatever, no matter how many maverick they are, no matter how many mistakes they make, how many ways they behave badly, fundamentally, we know they're good guys. The journalist example, and this has happened in so many movies, it's less prevalent in television because there are less TV things about journalists, but there's lots of films about journalists. When you see a maverick journalist get into their Saab or arrive at the scene of a crime to investigate or something, and they get out of a battered old Saab, we know that they're not going to listen to the received wisdom and be kowtow to the establishment. We know that they're going to take their independent view, and therefore we trust them.
That's because Saab is a very independent car, mate. Yeah,
exactly. And it's symbolism. It's used as symbolism. And that's why I'm fascinated by the link between popular culture and brands. So we could get into that one. I'm going to write a PhD about it one day. But
so as a fine, I mean, that's a lovely piece of connection for people that I think that to look at popular culture in terms of their own products or their own projects. That's quite interesting. So
what does it mean? Brand is about meaning. It's all about meaning. What does it mean?
So moving off brand and moving to just to the final thing, if someone was looking to say, okay, so what's the secret, you know, what's the meaning of life? For you, what is the meaning of life? That's the final question I ask you. If someone else is looking for this question, what do you think the meaning of life is? Beyond 42.
42. I have absolutely no idea what the meaning of life is. I honestly don't know. I've always described myself as a card-carrying atheist, but then again, I was raised as a Roman Catholic, you know, and I think my turbulent inner life is a mixture of those two things. That's why I love symbolism, perhaps, but it's also why I try to be incredibly cold-bloodedly rational. I have no idea what the meaning of life is, except that and this sounds terribly, terribly cheesy, but we can only make our choices sort of minute by minute, day by day. So I think I try and focus on those now and, you know, in each moment as much as I can. I think that's all. I don't have anything very wise to say on that. I'm just another kind of mixed up middle-aged bloke, you know, like you. That's all.
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, as I said, I'm exploring this. I think there has to be a little bit more than just making money and, you know, passing the time.
Yes,
you know?
There absolutely is. I just don't know what it is. I suppose I would say that it's the ongoing search for meaning that stimulates me, but it's not the search for religious meaning. I don't study religion. I don't study spiritual things. I find my meaning in relationships and in what I can wring out of popular culture, I suppose. And I, I think it's, for me, it's about finding balance. You know, it's about accepting one's humanity, the human condition. We can't escape it. So, you know, we might as well accept it and make the most of it and be the best.
For me,
be as much at peace.
The question for me is how we keep going on this journey without getting to the space. Because, I mean, my neighbour was encapsulated for me in some ways. And I thought to myself, my God, if I ever get there. Because he used to go up to there's an old guy's place where they meet and play cards up the road. And he used to get a taxi up there. And I says, oh, how was it today? He goes, oh, PTT. And I says, sorry, PTT? Yeah, passes the time.
Ah, yeah, okay. I don't want to be there.
You know, and it was like my father. It's the gap between like breakfast. You know, it's that gap, filling the gap between breakfast and lunch.
Oh yeah, no, I never wanted to do that ever. That's a really good question. We're in danger of stretching this out. But when I in the times when I was not very well and I was kicking around on the beach at Southwold, you know, and anyone observing me might have thought, "Who's that lonely old git there?" I wasn't passing the time. I was nurturing my self, as it were. I was resting and preparing and not knowing what the meaning was, but knowing that there was a simple choice. There was either kind of walk into the sea, you know, or you had to find some meaning and purpose to stay on land. I never want to be at the passing the time stage. I think there's always going to be, like, when Blackshaw is finished, let's say Blackshaw is incredibly successful and I sell it for squillions of pounds in 5 years' time, okay? I'd better have to find something to do, you know, before that I get to that point. And I think I will.
Start your pop career.
Well, I doubt that very much. But I've always had an ambition to go to university and study history of art, which I failed to do when I was 18. Yeah. And I had the opportunity, didn't quite make the grades. I'd love to go back and study history of art. I would love to go. Wow. I would genuinely love to go and do a degree in TV detectives and their meaning. I'd love to write and to spend some. I'd like to write a sequence of novels and have the time just to do that. So I don't think I'm going to run out of stuff to do. I think. Yeah, and you're right. PTT, a bad idea and not very healthy. I think I will go on in one way or another until the day I drop, but it won't all be about, you know, business. Business is just the thing that stimulates me right now.
So, Simon Middleton, thank you so much for taking the time to be with me today.
It's a pleasure. It's lovely to talk to you. I really enjoyed it.
Just the as the I mean, you've given me the address for Blackshaw, so I'll put that on the details on the page so that people can find you.
Yeah,
is that is that the best way to get in touch with you if anyone wants to?
Or my email address is simon@blackshaw.cc. So if anybody wants to email me and challenge me about the prevalence of Volvos in detective fiction, they can.
Wow. Okay. No one puts their email address out on these things normally. That's quite a surprise. I missed the first thing you said. When I said there was a kind of glitch, and so just before your email address, you said something else. You can contact me via.
Oh, I think it was the website. It's just blackshaw.cc.
Okay. Lovely. Yeah. Lovely. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time, Simon. It really has been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. I'd love to do it again.
I think we will certainly do it again, because I think there's a deeper conversation to have, particularly about detectives and cars.
Yeah. Well, do send me the link. I'd love to share it with people if that's all right.
I will certainly do that. All the best.
Okay.
And that was Life, Passion and Business with Paul Harvey and my guest Simon Middleton. You can find the contact details for Simon and the Blackshaw Project on the website at lifepassionandbusiness.com. If you've enjoyed the programme, please share it on social media or subscribe to it on your podcast app, or better still, leave us a review somewhere. It only remains me to say thanks for listening, and I hope to catch you later. All the best.